Hello and welcome to the Africa Today podcast from the BBC at 1530 GMT on Tuesday, 13th July. I'm Paul Bachabinga. In the pod today, Ugandan police say they found crucial clues to Sunday's devastating bomb attacks in Kampala.
A suicide vest, which with the help of the residents of Kampala, were able to find in a discotheque.
The death of a teenager leads to clashes in a refugee camp in Kenya. And after the Church of England takes a move towards ordaining women bishops, we go to Malawi for a reaction.
The biggest number of people who have voted this motion down has been women. Some would have very strong theological reasons, and then there are others who have their own misgivings about women in general taking on leadership.
Police in Uganda say they have arrested suspects in connection with a bomb blast which killed at least 76 people in the capital Kampala on Sunday night. The Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab have said they were behind the explosions. Police investigators have also displayed some of their first findings at a news conference in Kampala. Our reporter Joshua Mali was there and told my colleague Hassan Aruni more.
Well, the police displayed a suicide vest which was found at another site in Kampala. And that's a place called Machindye, southeast of Kampala. And they say this vest maybe could have meant a third explosion was planned. And after the press conference, I was able to speak to the police chief, Kale Kaihura, and asked about his findings.
A suicide vest, which with the help of the residents of Kampala, were able to find in a discotheque. Presumably by somebody who either changed his mind for whatever reason, but definitely was abandoned there, and we got it. Had it gone off, perhaps that would have been the third location of this bombing.
Do the components of what was contained there have any links with what was used in the blast?
Yes, we have seen a relationship because some of the components, like ball bearings. In fact, I strongly believe that this suicide vest must have been the same type that was used in both locations, at the restaurant and at the rugby club. And it's consistent because the two blasts there, we suspect one could have been a suicide bomb, the other one was definitely placed there.
Do you have any clue who could have put the vest there?
At this stage, we don't. We are starting to make arrests, but it's too premature to say whether these are necessarily directed.
When do we expect information about them?
You will see, you'll get it. We are compiling the files.
Uganda's Chief of Police, Kale Kaihura, there. And Joshua, the Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab had said it was behind the attacks. Did the police chief say anything about that?
Yes, indeed, Mr. Kaihura said the bomber's modus operandi appeared to support the claim. But he also said that many of these groups work together. He pointed a finger, for example, at a group called the Allied Democratic Forces. And this is what he said when asked about the identity of those arrested.
I am not yet. There could be some Somalis, that's right. But I can't talk about the nationality. Please. By the way, let me say this. Al-Shabaab is linked with ADF. ADF is composed of Ugandans. Yes, this one is the fact. Al-Shabaab and ADF are linked with Al-Qaeda. You know this? So let's not dwell so much on Somalis. Please. This is not a question of nationality. This is a question of evildoers. And from information we have, they work together.
And who exactly are the ADF that he mentions?
Well, this is a rebel group operating in western Uganda at the border with the DRC. And some people say they are a creation of the ruling party, especially the opposition, including Besigye, have often been accused of collaboration or having links with the ADF. It has also been said that they have links with Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab in the past. But some here at the moment are suggesting that the mentioning of the ADF might be a political move, rather than just the results of police investigations.
Meanwhile, today is the first day of a week of national mourning. What's the mood like in Kampala?
Well, the mood is still somber. People are still exchanging messages of condolence. It's sorrowful. Kampala is not the same Kampala that you would have seen last week. The fun-loving people are not going about casually or usually having fun as they always do. The mood is still very, very somber.
In the immediate aftermath of the bombings, the government promised to increase security in Uganda, particularly ahead of the African Union summit, which is due to take place next week. Is there much evidence of this on the ground?
Yes, there is. At the moment, going into one of the biggest shopping malls in the city, which is called Garden City, I could see long lines of vehicles being scanned, and people entering that particular mall have to be scanned with the metal detectors as well. Bus stations, people are also being checked, and police officers patrolling around the city. It's usual they do that, but right now there is a heavier presence of police officers patrolling the city.
The BBC's Joshua Mali in Kampala. Meanwhile, countries across the region have been tightening security in the aftermath of the bombings and in response to the warnings issued by the Somali radical Islamist group Al-Shabaab to Uganda and Burundi. The BBC's Robert Kipto has been monitoring developments from Nairobi.
East African countries are on high alert following twin bombs attack in Kampala on Sunday night. In Kenya, security has been heightened along porous Kenya-Somali border. Kenya's army spokesman Bokita Ongeri has said that the government has sent a contingent of Kenyan army personnel and regular police to patrol the 682-kilometer stretch border with Somalia. He said the army is also conducting strict checks on both foreigners and Kenyans transversing the two countries. Kenya has a reason to be concerned as the country supports the fragile transitional federal government in Somalia, and the country is also seen as a second home for the Somali government. The country has also been attacked several times, the deadliest incident being the killings of more than 200 people at the American Embassy in Nairobi in 1998. Kenya also hosts thousands of Somali immigrants seeking refuge in the country. The situation is similar in neighboring Tanzania. Hours after the attack took place, top military personnel held a crisis meeting in Dar es Salaam to look for ways of ensuring safety of all its citizens. The government has also asked its citizens to be vigilant, especially when gathering in public places. The country also hosts several Somali immigrants. In neighboring Ethiopia, security is already tight since the people there have all along been paranoid about security, particularly along the border with Somalia. The people there are subject to security checks almost everywhere.
The report there by Robert Kipto in Nairobi. Early this morning, the discovery of a dead Somali teenager in the Hagadera refugee camp in northeast Kenya has sparked violent clashes between its Somali and Sudanese residents. To find out about a possible motive for the boy's death, Hassan Aruni spoke to the BBC's Bashkas Jugsode, who's in Garissa town, 80 kilometers from the camp.
Some of the Somali refugees whom I spoke to in that camp tell me that they had some leads which were actually taking them to the camp where the Sudanese were leaving some of their houses, and they also say that they believe the Sudanese are involved in some kind of witchcraft, because some parts of this young man's body were missing, like the heart, the kidneys, and other parts were missing. So they are saying that they are very sure that at least that killing was carried away by the Sudanese refugees, and that is why they were retaliating.
The BBC's Bashkas Jugsode. Well, the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, runs the Hagadera refugee camp. Spokesperson Emmanuel Nyabera in Nairobi gave Hassan Aruni more details of what happened today and of what the UN is doing to contain the situation.
No, it's just unfortunate that there's an incident that happened today where a life was lost and a number of injuries sustained. This morning, a body of around 14-year-old boy was found, a Somali boy, was found close to the residence of Sudanese. And this caused a lot of tension and conflict between Somalis and Sudanese. Because of that, around 35 people were injured. So seven of them were admitted in the morning, but some of them went to the hospital later with minor injuries. The Somalis assumed that this boy was killed by Sudanese, and because of that, they started attacking one of the Sudanese blocks that accommodates around 300 people. What we have done at the moment is we've actually evacuated the whole block. We have taken all the Sudanese who are there, around 300 of them, from Hagadera to another camp, which is called Ifo. We used four trucks to move them from Hagadera to Ifo.
Emmanuel Nyabera, spokesman of the UNHCR in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In Ghana, intrigue and controversy still surround the circumstances and impact of the fire which gutted the residence of Ghana's former president, Jerry Rawlings, in February this year. Last week, the former First Lady, Nana Akonadu Rawlings, claimed on local radio that she and her husband had been left homeless by the state. And this week, a photojournalist has alleged he was abducted and traumatized by security men while investigating that claim. The BBC's David Amano reports from Accra.
Two journalists working for Ghana's Insight newspaper went to one of the Rawlings residences on Monday to follow up on the homeless issue raised by the former First Lady. After taking pictures of the private home in the Adjugano suburb of Accra, the photographer, Dauda Mohammed, says he was confronted by three burly, well-dressed men in a four-wheel drive vehicle, one of them wielding a knife. The other journalist, Duke Tego, told the BBC he watched as his colleague was chased into nearby bushes and bundled into the back of the car. He said he was reunited with Dauda on Monday evening, describing his condition as unhurt but traumatized. According to Dauda, he had been driven to a building approximately half a kilometer away from the Rawlings residence, where he was questioned before managing to escape through an unlocked door. However, during an interview with Accra's Joy FM radio station this morning, Dauda's testimony was challenged by an anonymous caller, claiming it was himself, a concerned citizen, who had confronted Dauda on account of his suspicious behaviour. Speaking to the BBC today, Kofi Adams, the spokesperson for former President Rawlings, said there was no kidnapping and that the story was a hoax generated by Insight editor Kwesi Pratt and his people. Attempts to get a response from Mr. Pratt have failed. However, one of the journalists rejected Mr. Adams' assertion, saying the Insight would have no motive for generating a frame-up. Mrs. Rawlings' appearance on local radio last week became a talking point when she spoke about looking for a place to rent and having to sleep apart from her husband. It also led to a public quarrel between her supporters and officials of the government of President John Atta Mills. Deputy Information Minister James Ajinim Bwateng was on the receiving end of some very unflattering words after suggesting Mrs. Rawlings had unilaterally turned down two good offers of alternative accommodation. Flowery stupidity, mental incompetence and unbridled arrogance. These were some of the insults hurled by a group calling themselves Friends of Nana Akonadu Ajiman Rawlings. An official investigation into the cause of February's fire has yielded no result. Mrs. Rawlings, who has presidential ambitions, has expressed a desire for the official residence, a colonial home on stilts, to be rebuilt by the state.
David Amano reporting. The Church of England has voted in a draft legislation to allow the ordination of women bishops. The Church of England first allowed the ordination of women priests in 1992, but allowing women to go for the more senior role of bishop has been difficult to achieve. In Africa, some Anglican churches still do not have any female priests at all. One of them is the Diocese of Southern Malawi. My colleague Hassan Aruni called up the bishop there, the Right Reverend James Tenga Tenga, and asked him for his reaction to the decision by the Anglican Communion's mother church.
Well, the Church of England has made its mind up, and they have decided that they would like to ordain women as bishops, and that should be fine.
But I understand that in your diocese there are still no female priests yet.
No, there are no women priests yet in the province of Central Africa, yes.
But the Church of England did agree that there will be women priests as far back as 1992. How come you still don't have women priests?
Well, each province makes its own decision when it makes it, and so the province of Central Africa has not yet.
Are you yourself opposed to women being priests in your diocese?
Not personally.
So would you be encouraging some women or even some males to come up with this motion?
It's not for me to encourage. I mean, people have done it, and people who want to talk and want assistance in talking about it and in raising the motion, we've always had those discussions. In fact, we were having similar discussions with some women in the diocese last year.
Is it a big issue for you?
Neither here nor there.
What do the women in your diocese think, though? Because surely they've discussed that with you.
The biggest number of people who have voted this motion down whenever it was raised has been women.
Why is that?
Well, some, just the same way as men and women who have voted against the motion, has been that, well, it's the church historically has never done so, why now? And is it change for its own sake, or is it the church conforming to society's changes? others would think have very strong theological reasons where they think, well, it doesn't quite occur well. It doesn't quite represent their image of what they think God would like. And then there are others who have their own misgivings about women in general taking on leadership. So it's a varied group of people who oppose the ordination of women.
James Tengatenga, Bishop of Southern Malawi. That's it for today. Thank you for downloading the Africa Today podcast from the BBC, recorded weekdays at 15:30 GMT. I'm Paul Bachabinga. Until next time, goodbye.